Thank you, Jeff. When you started commenting on one of the statements made this morning, I thought maybe you'd run right through them all and comment on them too, including, I thought, a couple of interesting comments that are quite counter to what you were saying about the belief that the industry would not protect the environment on its own and it would take government to assure that. I'm going to read a couple of messages or list a few names here available at the registration desk. Steve Reed, Dr. Kopach, I guess he still isn't here, doesn't like messages. Don Friedman, R. Jones, Rosemary Nauman, Colonel Hardin, Kenneth Richards, Mr. Boardman, Dr. Fitzgerald, Tom Woodruff, a message for Peek and Weisheimer to contact Nez. Now, I'm going to recess for only 5 minutes to get coffee. You're welcome to bring it back. We'll reconvene in 5 minutes right here. Next speaker will be Gene Guest, and if those of you don't feel like coming back in for a while, don't come in. Drift in later.
What a blow.
Almost go public is Gene Guest. Gene is a longtime legislator. He's the chairman of the Legislative Council. And Gene has been listening to all the things that have been said here. He's going to comment on some of the statements that have been made here today, as well as look upon the issues that we're talking about from the standpoint of what the legislature is doing, and do his best to, in one voice, talk for 60 rather divergent views. Gene?
Chairman Vick, members of the panel, ladies and gentlemen, with that closing remark before the coffee break, I thought I would forego talking about the oil and gas industry and discuss the university budget for the next decade. Of course, no individual legislator can speak for the legislature. I can only hope I can express some viewpoints of the majority of my colleagues. The primary issue facing us in the next session of the legislature and subsequent sessions, but primarily the next one, since we will be dealing with the programming of excess revenues, we hope, is what do we wish to make of the state of Alaska? That is the issue, and that will be the issue for the next decade. Now, those of us in the legislature, of course, as the question was raised here earlier, can we learn? Yes, we can learn. And there's much that we have to learn before the next session and during the next session. However, there is also much, there's a reserve of knowledge in the legislature itself. We know of Alaska's history. This is one of the primary things that we have to consider in dealing with policy. We know of the workings of the mining industry and the fishing industry, and of the other exploitations that have taken place in Alaska. We have people who may represent the city of Cordova, where they can't get the automobile out by railroad, yet they know that there's a big hole in the mountain where all the copper was taken out and no severance tax ever paid on it. We have a representative perhaps from Dillingham who knows that since the turn of the century, $2 billion in fishing products have been taken out of Bristol Bay, yet there's a schoolroom shortage in Dillingham. We know the history of Alaska from that aspect. We are also aware, since a number of us came from other states, of the ecological problems we're faced with. We know what has happened in other states, and I think that we will be doing our best in attempting to ready ourselves to deal with these problems. I would like to comment just for a moment on Mr. Eckhardt's statement concerning the investment of money. We've heard this quite often, and as I'm sure as Professor Engel pointed out in his book, the same argument is made in the Midwestern legislatures and arguing for a additional depletion allowance in the Williston Basin. Actually, and I think I can speak for the legislature in this point, we do get, we're kind of tired of the line, to put it bluntly. We know that the oil industry has invested a great deal in Alaska. We're quite aware of that. We know also that the investment is, of course, to bring on a profit. We're aware of that. We're also aware of other things that make Alaska attractive to the oil and gas industry. Certainly the closeness to the West Coast, the existence of an oil deficit on the West Coast, the fact that Alaskan oil isn't subject to import restrictions, the fact that we have a favorable business climate, the fact that our unitization and leasing policies are quite modern and quite liberal. These we have to balance off in our mind when we start talking about the large investment of the oil and gas industry in the state of Alaska. I would like to outline just shortly for a moment the workings of the Legislative Council in preparation for the next session. We have taken the impact of the oil industry as one of our subjects for discussion and hopefully coming up with a legislative program for the next session. We've split this into two sections. One, we'll be dealing with a program for the expenditures of any excess revenues. Now, this program doesn't necessarily mean spending the money. It's how we're going to deal with the funds we're going to receive. To that end, we will be holding later on this year a series of four conferences, 2.5 days each, involving legislators, leading citizens around the state, experts in conservation, experts in oil and gas, economists, etc. And from this, we will come up with a basic policy position on various issues facing the state of Alaska today. The second phase of that will be, this will be then developed into a legislative program to be presented to the legislature in January. The second phase of our study is what we consider the policy position of the relationship of the oil and gas industry to the state of Alaska. This will take in leasing problems, taxation, bills now pending for the legislature, such as mandatory checkerboarding, the knocking out of unitization, which one bill calls for, other matters pending before the legislature. In this particular phase, we will be using consultants. We have not settled on one or a group at this point, but we will settle on it by our September meeting. Now, as a legislature, of course, it is our function to set policy at that level, and it is particularly our function to represent the public interest, and this includes being fair to the oil industry. And in carrying out these two functions, we are going to have to become more educated and more sophisticated, and certainly start using the knowledge we have as well as the knowledge of outside consultants. One comment along the line of the policy in relation to the oil industry. Professor Engel, in his approach to the industry, reminds me of a situation I was in once. I'd gone to a village to the westward to take a deposition, and I went to the trading post owner and I asked him, "What do you know about so-and-so?" The deposition I was going to take, and he looked me square in the eye and he says, "He's all bad." And I don't particularly care for that approach. I think that there are a lot of things we can learn, and that a lot of things we can learn from the past, and we can prevent abuses in the future. But as a practicing politician, and as a practical politician, you do not deal in a vacuum. You deal in everyday practical matters. So you can't take the approach, in my opinion, that something is all bad or all good. It is certainly our function to take alternative approaches and come up with a policy which is to the best benefit of the state and to the industry. Thank you very much.
Gene, thank you very much. The Legislative Council programs that Gene Guest was talking about are really very impressive in their breadth and formulation, and I think will be very important to achieving the kind of policies that will be significant toward promoting the public interest in Alaska. Now, I said we'll almost go public. We have so far had every speaker comment on our first speaker, and it seems only fair to give him a chance to comment back just briefly. Robert Engler.
One of the hazards of being first is that you may not pay attention afterwards, and I wish to thank each of the participants for keeping me alert because I kept hearing my name. Having said that, I really think this is supposed to be a scholarly conference. I mean, that's how I read it. And I think if someone has a disagreement, I think there's an obligation not to call a name, but to offer a fact or to take any case study. Now, I may be guilty in trying to compress in 15 minutes what I spent 8 years trying to put together and study, what I've testified before Senate committees, what I've written extensively. I still haven't heard, and I see one gentleman's hair is back down now, and I'm glad, because I don't want to be responsible for that. But rather than simply call this a picture of a mafia, I think take an example and use one of those either, or say you don't know the facts. If my picture of the Iranian story is not true, say so, or ask me about it. Do the same thing with any of these issues. But just to say it's too much is very convenient, but I'm afraid it doesn't answer anything in particular. The facts about the National Petroleum Council, the surveillance of all institutions, I've spoken and I've written about, and I'd wish anyone who wants to challenge it would do so on the record, and not by name calling and not by innuendo about what I might be or what my loyalties might be. I'd say this, the picture of man as evil as my portrait amuses me. It implies that man is only for oil or petroleum. I always thought men were for farming, for love, for poetry, for a million things. And to make that kind of equation is, again, simple, and of course it leaves me outside the human race, I suppose. And to suggest that there are other people who may have a stake in the resources of the society than oil men, if that makes me subversive or if that makes me name-calling, then I stand guilty of that. To say that I said all oil is bad denies actually most of what I've written and a little bit, I admit, of what I said today. I did say a couple of sentences, if you remember them, about they had contributed to the comfort and development. In fact, I spent a great deal of time in my writing describing oil as operating on the frontier of technological organization and management organization. And I thought, as one who's interested in the nature of modern industry, we have much to learn about this planning mechanism, as the luncheon speaker said, which is not to mean I celebrate technique or I celebrate corporate management. To say, again, jumping around very quickly, because I'll quit in a minute on this, that I'm against self-interest and in favor of monolithic planning is, I think, a bit unfair. I think it's a bit unfair. The concept of the individual is very deep in me. My deepest roots are conservative. I think the liberal heritage was based on a belief in men having a rifle, a Bible, a farm, and a single vote, and men could defend their own lives and their families and their consciences with that kind of resource. And that kind of self-interest was understandable in a society of small farmers and entrepreneurs. But when you're talking about giant private governments, when you're talking about the first world government, which is what the oil industry has been in certain important respects, you cannot just simply say that self-interest ought to rule and not examine the resources at the disposal of the self-interest of the oil industry as opposed to the self-interest of the Eskimo, the farmer, the school teacher, the housewife, and millions of other people in this country and in the world. And so it's not that I'm against self-interest. And as far as to say that I'm in favor of monolithic or that monolithic planning is what I call for, I'm afraid that opens a tremendous discussion. I think we've all been sobered by what appeared to be in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s examples abroad of what appeared to be easy monolithic planning. But there are many other definitions of planning, and there's everything to be learned. To assume that organized business and capitalism represents the last word in human wisdom is really to mock the tragedy of people who have lost the ability to think, reason, or feel. All I'm asking for is to think through some alternative ways of appraising the range of interest, the range of concerns. And it is possible to define a public interest without talking about monoliths, without talking about dictators, whether public or private. I think Mr. Thompson is dead right. I mean, there's no secret. I was talking about the system and not about oil. I thought it was a measure of some of the audience, how they responded to the reference to oil. I do want to raise questions about the nature of the social system. That's no secret. My concern is not so much, as a matter of fact, with the oil men, but all the people from petroleum geologists and editors who accept a definition of self-interest, which is essentially the oil industry's one. That's my concern, really. Now, to move on very briefly again, the question was raised, and not answered thoroughly, who would you expect to run the oil industry for a public point of view if it was not someone trained in oil? Well, that's an interesting question, and that's a big philosophic question, and it's not simply answered by saying you go to a lawyer when you have a legal problem. Many of us learn to keep away from them when you have legal problems. I would point out, for example, just two quick quotations. Santa Barbara was not an accident, and Santa Barbara is going to happen again and again and again. And as someone wisely said this morning, hopefully we learn from it. And the guilt is not a simple one. The federal government was greedy and ignorant, that is, its representatives. The federal government took in, I'm talking fast without data here, perhaps $4 billion in leases. Oh boy, lots of money. The federal government now admits its representatives that they have made no study in the last 15 years for safeguarding the waters in such drilling. Though earlier, when they wanted the money, they being the federal agencies here, they rushed in for the money and said, don't worry. All the local officials at Santa Barbara now say, we never got a chance to raise the resource questions, or we weren't heard, or we were told, don't worry. After Santa Barbara, just a few days ago, the oil industry in hearings on public hearings on offshore oil, the testimony of several corporations is interesting. Gulf Oil, for example, safe to name them, I don't think they're up here yet, although you know more than I do, testified as following. Gulf is concerned about the possibility that public hearings may be unduly prolonged by enabling persons or organizations having no real or substantial interest in a proposed lease sale to unduly delay leasing of the outer continental shelf. This could be detrimental in the proper and timely development of these mineral resources by creating so much delay as to discourage Gulf and other companies from participating in these leasing sales. Another company, Pan American Petroleum, testifies that public hearings on leases of offshore lands involving, we don't know how many billions, the words have no meaning, I quote, would divert attention from important concerns involving national defense and anticipated fuel needs, and provides a forum largely devoted to an emotional attack on the oil and gas industry. Who's going to speak for the public interest if you only say those qualified are those who have a particular dimension of an oil interest? Or if you assume that, well, there are issues that we're all united on. Today, everyone's against pollution. Or I wonder if you really believe that. At a national conference on air pollution, a top official of a major oil company discussing corporate responsibility said, and the responsibility to the community and so forth, was talking about the prime responsibility, of course, to the stockholders to minimize costs and so forth. He said there's also responsibility to the community, to welfare and so forth. But this is what I want to quote. But there is another side to this coin also, I'm quoting this senior vice president of a major oil company. A community which insists on too rigorous air pollution controls imposes too stringent air quality standards or sets up and tries to administer an unfair, discriminatory, or confiscatory air pollution control program in the long run harms itself. I can assure you from personal experience that is not just idle talk, that industries do very definitely assess the air pollution control policies of a community, among other factors, before deciding on the location of a new plant or the expansion of an existing one. Wherever I've studied this kind of operation, the threat is clear, and I've studied it in many of the states, that if you play rough with us on taxes, if you impose too strict standards, then the climate is not healthy and we will leave. I watched a large oil company in one state make speech after speech of this on this line, where oil was discovered in North Dakota. At the same time, they were building a steel, a concrete building headquarters with very reinforced foundations to expand the building way up. They're not going to leave or not leave that simply. But this threat as to climate is a clear illustration that you cannot assume naturally that because now there is a general consensus against air pollution, that therefore the oil industry or any other segment of the society is an adequate guardian of a larger domain. As a very last point, and perhaps unfairly, because Mr. Eckhart did not attack me, in fact defended the right of dissent, it seems unfair that I should pick on his facts, and yet I'd like to. Everyone is trying to impress you people with the costs of this industry, the costs of the development. Gee, thanks, Dad. Let me tell you something. Have you ever asked the question, who pays for this? Have you ever asked the question where this money comes from? This afternoon, this evening, if you drive a car, start a simple educational exercise for yourself, and I'll quit, Vic, with this pedagogical note. Pull into your friendly local gas station. Ask them about the cost of oil, the cost of gasoline. Then trace the question as far up as you can to the top economists of the oil industry, perhaps to Mr. Frank in London and so forth. And you'll get answers, all of which are accurate. That is, the local man may say taxes are very high, but they aren't. But I'd like to tell you that when you pay for a gallon of gasoline, you're not paying for the cost of producing that gas. You're paying for the replacement cost. You're paying so that the industry can go out and, from its point of view, for your benefit, build the pipelines, earmark the resources in the fields for 20 years hence, so when you drive up at the 40th Annual Science Conference of Alaska and say, fill her up, you won't be turned away. Now, I'd like to submit to you that that turns capitalism on its heels, because it means that you as a consumer are the investor, only you have no rights. You are the investor. That is not risk capital. And the bulk of oil investment thus far in the post-World War II period is generated internally, meaning that the great bulk of corporate investment comes from its own resources, which it's put aside from the cost of gasoline which it sets, rather than in the classic simple picture of the capitalist model where people compete, and if someone else wants to expand or invest, they have to go to their savings bank or they have to go to the market or what have you. So I would just note that when everyone tries to impress you with these astronomical figures, one ought to ask some questions about where the cost, who pays for this. And I would say that not only is the risk minimum in the sense of if you trace the dollar of investment, but if you add to this the study of the tax structure, the study of the imports, and don't call me a name, ask me a question, please. Who pays for the import? How the import policies jack up by perhaps 50% the price of oil in the United States. This is a subsidy paid by the consumer and by the U.S. government as taxpayer. Conservative economists estimate, like Friedman, most conservative economist, estimates, Goldwater's economist, estimates that we subsidize the industry perhaps $4 billion a year on things like that. Now, I'm talking fast and with closer figure. I mean, with more time, I'd give a better figure on that and what I think. If you look at all the advantages the industry gets, which are not normal and appropriate to any, the use of the military, the use of subsidies, you will discover, I think, that there's much more to be said about the cost than, gee whiz, let's be grateful.
Thank you, Bob. I think the point was well taken. Let's turn this over to the audience. No names, questions, as specific as possible. Please give your name, identification, if you wish.
My name is Greg Erickson, and I'd like to direct a question to Mr. Kelly, who stated that one of his responsibilities was to maximize revenue for the state of Alaska. I'd just like to know precisely what he means by that in terms of revenue today and revenue tomorrow. Generally, it's considered that revenue today is worth something more than revenue tomorrow, and these two values are adjudicated with a discount rate or an interest rate, and I wonder what kind of interest rate he uses in evaluating the state's income today against the income tomorrow.
Mr. Erickson's question, basically insofar as looking at interest rates and the derivation of future royalties, the state does enter upon a projection as far as its revenues from whether they be oil or gas or minerals on a five-year basis. I think that the application, certainly to any economist, that a dollar today is obviously more valuable than one discounted over a period of years, is certainly valid. Now, we don't, or at least I specifically, not being an economist, do not approach a return on every, you might say, on a rate of return percentage-wise on each specific resource. I think that what one must do in projecting and indicating revenues to be derived at a maximum must consider all of the various factors involved, economics, trade relationships, world situations, as best fits Alaska's particular and unique position. I think these factors, over and above just a straight interest application, must be considered. These we have attempted, certainly, and with all means at our disposal, to determine.
Thank you very much. After hearing the luncheon speech, I'm sure you'll now go ahead and use scientific method in making these determinations. Who's Would you please give us your name, sir?
I'm Joe Josephson of the Alaska State Senate, and this is for Professor Engler. Could you amplify your statement that it would be in the interest of the state of Alaska, specifically, if the Congress and our delegation in Congress supported a change in the oil depletion allowance and relaxed provisions regarding oil imports? I'm interested in the specific well-being, you said, the long-range interest of Alaska on this question.
Okay. In the case of the import control, what this does, of course, is provide an umbrella over certain producers in the United States, so-called small producers, who are very often inefficient, which may be a legitimate. There are other values besides economic. I'm not arguing that the test initially is inefficiency, but the fact is most of the wells in the United States don't produce oil; they trickle it. And there's very little oil in these wells that we get out daily. And they are high-cost operations, and they are subsidized. They are subsidized by the import policy, which also, of course, subsidizes a whole host of refiners, because every barrel of oil that's admitted into the United States is worth about, well, again, I'm talking fast, but at least $1.25, as $1.25 subsidy to the refiner. These tickets are traded back and forth among the industry, and taxpayers are paying for paper tickets, which end up worth a fortune for industry. Now, what I'm saying is that the consumer and the citizen pays twice on import control. He pays a heavy subsidy to prop up a domestic industry, and one guise is national security, and enough has been said about that nonsense, I think, today. If the oil industry really believed in national security on that level, why has it fought to oppose a pipeline through Canada? Why has it fought for secret relationships with Canada, which in effect limit the import of oil from Canada, even though presumably we're part of, you know, larger defense considerations? So on the one hand, as general citizens of the United States, you're paying a subsidy, a very heavy subsidy, for the privilege of paying a very high price for oil. Now, you could argue there are social benefits for high-priced oil. That is, if the oil industry really believed in conservation, maybe it should stop pushing travel and maybe agitate for good mass transportation in our cities instead of for automobile travel and so forth. That's for the general citizenry. In terms of the specifics of Alaska, it seems to me that there's a lot more homework to be done here on the import control, but it is clear to me that you're not going to benefit in the short or the long run by the maintenance of present import control, because you have a very different productive system here. You're not defending a handful of wells, or not a handful, or maybe 300,000 of them, of wells which have been badly depleted in terms of their resource or are played out. You're talking about fields which conceivably, and I'm not pretending to know, I have no knowledge here, are very rich in resource. I don't see where you're going to gain on a, well, okay.
Yeah. I'd like to keep this moving as fast as possible. Frank.
That's all right, then. Go ahead. All
okay,
right.
Fine. Is that enough, Joe? For time being, you can pursue it later.
I would like to pursue it with that answer. I don't think this question was answered. That's all.
I'd like to, excuse me, my name's Paul Bradley. I'm at the University of British Columbia.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. I'd like to address a question to Mr. Ickard, which will give him a chance to possibly answer the question on the floor. First of all, I do wish a clarification from you. I thought I heard you say that it cost $20,000 to drill a well at Prudhoe Bay, and that struck me as a remarkable figure. So would you, if you did comment, would you correct that? But secondly, my question relates to this matter of the depletion allowance. Your major point in your paper seems to be that overall exploration activity will fall off in the United States if the depletion allowance is reduced, and that certainly seems likely. On the other hand, an Alaskan, it seems to me, who heard the discussion this morning in which considerable optimism was expressed over developing the North Slope in order to import to Europe and elsewhere, it seems to me could reasonably say, okay, so what if overall exploration falls off? We've got enough stripper wells in Texas. Maybe I shouldn't really be very worried about the specter that you raised in connection with the depletion allowance. So if you could comment on that and then also make the clarification, please.
Well, on the $20,000, what I attempted to do was to make some comparison between costs in the north as against in the south. And the figure I used, as I recall, was $20,000 a day that it cost to run a rig, and these are round figures, on the North Slope as against a much lesser figure to the states to the south. And I really was not so much trying to be exact in my figures as to give some comparison between the conditions in that area as against a milder climate and a more conventional areas. Now, as to the matter of percentage depletion, as to whether or not it would affect exploratory drilling, I don't quite understand what you mean by the stripper wells. Of course, as you understand, most stripper wells, in fact, all stripper wells are not affected by proration, so they're running at least theoretically at full blast now. So I don't see where any falling off in drilling would increase their capacity or increase their production any.
Frank, I think the question basically was addressed to the question from Alaska's point of view. If the regulations and tax laws were changed, would the effect not be to slow down exploration, to slow down development in the other states, but not necessarily affect Alaska? Wasn't that the chances are that based on what was described this morning, if there was one place to invest, the money would probably still flow to Alaska.
Well, I think the commitment, as was indicated this morning, has been a substantial commitment made to Alaska, certainly. Now, I would like to take exception to what the professor just said about the matter of the generation of capital and cost. This is, and I would suggest very respectfully that he review his studies of the last few years when he says that the industry generates all of its capital within. I think if he'll look at the last several years, he'll see that is certainly no longer the case. And like the professor, I do not have...
I didn't say all, sir. I said most.
Well, I understood you to
Chase
say
Manhattan
all.
Chase Manhattan Bank.
Yeah.
Annual report, the Chase Manhattan Bank study of the major oil companies just out.
But the point is, if you're also well aware of the fact that there have been substantial capital requirements that have not been made internally, and if you'll examine the report, you'll see that many of the companies, I understood you, and there's no use of us arguing about all or most. I misunderstood you. But in any event, I can't see that if there is not, or if there is a substantial change in the tax treatment by the federal government, it certainly will have a marked effect on exploratory drilling. Now, maybe not as much effect in north in the Prudhoe Bear area, the north, as it will say, in East Texas. But that's a matter of degree, and the effect would still there. And I don't think the development would occur as rapidly as you could expect it to occur under the present tax treatment.
Thank you. Further questions? Jack?
I'm Jack Roderick. This is a question for Dr. Thompson or Jeff Laramie, primarily because one's a Canadian and one's a Britisher. We heard at noon that we Alaskans should be looking for some goals, and I think it's a part of this conference is for that purpose. With the amount of oil that we think is up on the North Slope right now, is there, in your judgment, any reason to think that we should not be too anxious to find any more oil in Alaska based on the supposition that our population may just double in 10 years? In other words, we may have only 500,000 people. Now, with the amount of oil that we now know is on the North Slope, from looking at it now just from an Alaskan standpoint, are we under great pressure now to discover more oil?
I might comment first. I think the situation in Alaska is one where all the initiatives and incentives that could possibly be needed to result in a continued high pace of exploration are right there in the discoveries that have been made, and it should no longer be a concern of the state of Alaska legislature to look for ways of offering incentive to exploration. Their problem, as I see it, is going to be how to use wisely the revenues that they'll receive.
I think part of the question was maybe we have enough, and do we really need more here if it brings more population in and so on?
Well, I don't see the question in that light, Vic, simply
okay.
Because you've got a situation going here now that's got its own momentum, and what you're really asking is should they slow it down somehow?
That's what he was asking.
Well, the way that that would be feasible, of course, would be to be a little slow about putting acreage on the market. And if that's the question, I would think that the state ought to be a bit cautious, because $1 billion, if that's the figure, is an awful lot to digest in terms of just how you're going to go about using it. And so there's no great rush, I would think, to realize on all that acreage.
Jeff?
Well, I find it difficult to answer the question unless somebody defines enough. I know Jack will appreciate this, but it is a concept. What is enough? We have a collection of exploration operators who have got into a basin, and despite what anyone may say about the oil industry, the exploration teams of the oil industry have sufficient scientific curiosity, and this in itself is passed upwards through the management structure of the industry, and it is extremely difficult once you've got the bit between your teeth to let go. An explorer hates to be told that he can't go and look for oil. And it is usually a matter of corporate planning that one area may have to give way in any given year to another. But it has been my experience that once you find a sedimentary basin which contains oil, and you have established the basic precepts which governs the accumulation of that oil, you will continue to look for it until you have exhausted the possibilities. The major sedimentary basins of the Middle East, the East Texas structures, it goes on and on and on. When you've found pool A and pool B, you start looking for deep oil. And this is a continuing quest. And despite what the cynics may say, I suspect that in addition to the monetary concern, and after all, I would remind our good friend that all of these people who are being oppressed are in fact shareholders in the petroleum industry. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. It doesn't exist as a sort of vast juggernaut to go trundling along crumbling things. It is owned by the public.
And the concept of giving up looking for oil is completely alien to the oil industry, because it's in the business to find the commodity. And we are thinking purely in terms of automobiles. We're thinking in terms of consumable fuels. If you consider the future and the fact that no oil company at the present moment can satisfy the demands of its petrochemical divisions for raw feedstocks, because the tops of the barrel are going in jet fuel, motor spirit, and so on. These are industries which are going to develop. These are industries for which there's going to be an increasing demand. And I think it would be highly unlikely, particularly in an atmosphere such as Alaska, which is frontier, its excitement, its involvement with the search for a new resource, and the possibility of great returns to the community. Nobody's going to give up, and I don't think the Alaskans would ask the oil industry to give up.
Jack agrees. He figures this is a philosophical question to be pursued over a couple of drinks. Gentleman in the back.
More. Rob Burledge from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. I wanted to ask Commissioner Kelly if he might comment in more detail about the suggestions that Professor Lovejoy made this morning and Professor Thompson this afternoon, that the state was proceeding in too risky and uninformed a way, perhaps on too large scale a way, perhaps in many other ways not prepared for the current round of leasing, whether the state has considered postponing these, whether it is considering revising leasing policies, and if so, how so? If not, why not?
It poses a number of questions that I hope I got all of them to answer. Insofar as the comments made by Professor Lovejoy and also others today at this panel regarding the state's selection of certain acreage to put up for this sale, obviously the reasons that we utilize our best judgment in doing this is of a nature particular to the situation of this particular sale. I do not think by any means that we have put up in a irrational or unthinking manner too much acreage. We still have 800,000 acres, give or take, in the same area as Prudhoe Bay. We have some large blocks, both uplands, and we have, of course, the bulk of the offshore lands to be offered in the future. The application of the Canadian policies, as were indicated by Professor Thompson, actually might be, had we had that in the, you might say, in our regulations or laws, might have been adaptable prior to the 1964 Prudhoe Bay sale. But as much as anything else, since these lands offered in this particular sale have previously been offered, they are somewhat scattered in nature, they are disjointed, it would be rather difficult to formulate a pattern which amounts to the Canadian Reservation System, the DRs, with the holding out of corridor lands. Vic, you had another question at the last.
I think that's enough. Are there any other questions after this?
I'm Charles Konigsberg from Alaska Methodist University. I don't think the panel should conclude without an opportunity for Mr. Kelly, Mr. Larminy, and Mr. Thompson to respond to Professor Engler's request for facts and not names. I do think he was unfairly treated, and the response was a shallow one.
You're castigated. I hope. Does anyone feel called upon? Gentleman in the yellow shirt.
John Borger, University of Alberta, Canada, Edmonton. One of the attacks were on Gulf. We have a representative here from Gulf Canada. I do want to say one thing in their defense. They have poured multi-million dollars into our University of Alberta, which attracts graduate students from out North America, because it pays the highest rate to the graduate students. There's
tremendous pressure on the government for more funds by these universities to support research projects, and expensive equipment is being purchased. And I can see, of course, that all these pressures borne on the government are going to put tremendous pressure on the government to get these funds. And where are they going to get them? From industry, from taxes. We can be caught in this kind of a circle and run the oil industry off the north slope of Fairbanks and chase them into Melville Island, into the territories, and develop that. We must be careful that we don't do this. We don't want to attack the oil company as an individual. They are made up of people, and as long as we go fighting against them, we can be sure that they will come to tables and always do something good for both sides. Therefore, we are creatures of extremes, and we're liable to condemn these oil industries too rapidly and quickly. Thank you.
I'll just comment on that I don't think that Dr. Engler was castigating any one particular company. He was simply quoting what a representative of Gulf had said. And I might mention that if he started responding, he would cite his book where he talks about the oil industry capturing universities by grants to universities. Dr. Bradley. And we wouldn't want that, of course.
My question is directed to my colleague at the University of British Columbia. There's been quite a bit of discussion of attitudes and so forth, so I don't want to comment on your characterization of Canadian attitudes, which was rather supine. I find it astonishing, in view of Canadians that I have met, and I trust that, in fact, Western Canadians are much more like Alaskans than your remarks would suggest. Now, I want to instead ask a more policy-oriented question. It was very useful to hear your frank statement that the goal of public policy should be maximization of state revenue. I think it should be pointed out that that's not the only possible goal, and that indeed that's not the same in the Canadian context as maximizing the income of all Canadians. My question has to do with prorationing. We heard this morning about the plight of the Canadian oil industry. It's being backed out of the West Coast. We know it can't compete in Eastern Canada. And I'm curious that your faith in our ability to learn from others has weathered the experience of watching the Alberta industry adapt Texas prorationing, because it seems to me that quite a direct line of reasoning suggests that the difficulties of the Alberta industry are related to its adaption of Texas-style prorationing. Thank you.
There are many aspects of the question, and I'll try to deal with a couple. First, I'd like to say something about Commissioner Kelly's decisions respecting management of Alaska's oil. This whole thing comes awful quick, and it's easy in hindsight to talk about the policies that should have been ready. But the one thing I admire, having studied U.S. leasing laws for quite a number of years and seen the situation in other parts of the states, was the fact that they stuck to competitive lease offering on the North Slope. And so instead of that acreage going off through a draw system on the basis of a $5 filing fee to anyone who happened to qualify as an applicant, instead of that, we have this September sale coming up. And that's one great credit to be put down to the Alaska people, whoever are responsible for it. As to my statement about maximizing revenues as a goal, I was talking in terms of the interest of Alaskans, and I'd premised it by remarking about the federal nature of this country. And an awful lot is explained by regional interests. The Alberta prorationing system, in many respects, is a part of its justification is a part of regional goals and interests. The people of Alberta, as producers, and not really as consumers at all, if you look in terms of the oil industry, have benefited greatly by the fact that the oil industry has this high price support system, and by the fact that they're taking large royalties and large cash bonuses from disposition of oil leases. In that light, then, you can understand the policy when you also put with it the fact that it's a state or provincial legislature that sets up the per-rationing system. Now, it started to get them into trouble with an inefficient industry supporting marginal wells, because after all, Alberta wants to keep well ahead of the United States, because they've got a little farther to go to attract that capital up there. So about 1964, they set about, in large measure, correcting the deficiencies, and by changing the system, they have contributed to a better working per-rationing system, and maybe the time will come when that'll have to be scrapped altogether. But in the interval, I think it can be explained in terms of what was in the interests of the local legislature. We were invited to comment on Professor Engler's remarks. In many respects, the situations he talks about, I think, are true in the sense that one set about to make that kind of determination can find facts to back them up. It can be said, I think, about much of industry, and maybe it relates to the venal streak in all of us. But what's required, to my mind, to deal with the situation is that we be prepared to, in effect, take less benefit, to pay the cost that's involved in pollution control. The industry will answer, and I think rightly, that if you want pollution control, it's going to cost money, and somebody's got to pay that money. And under our system, these costs get passed on to the consumer. Now, if we want these things, we have to pay for them. If the oil industry is getting too much, and that may be the case, then of course it's up to people like Robert Engler and a whole lot of us to be motivated to modify the system so that they don't get too much. But I see the problem in that light rather than in an attack broadly against the system.
I think we've sat through a fascinating session here. I'm not sure it was a confrontation. Confrontation means meeting head on. I don't think we quite had that. We sort of had some bouncing off and passing by. But I think that all of it was informational and educational. And the fact that everyone has sat through here with only a short break is an indication that our speakers, our discussants, have done an excellent job. With this, I will call the meeting to a close. I will remind you that there are additional sessions tonight at 7:30 and 8. We're reconvening tomorrow morning at 9. Thank you, gentlemen at the head table. Thank you, audience.